Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, joined as always by Ian Dark and John Rawling. This week we are looking at mind games in boxing, and we've all seen and experienced a few of them. I think we might have even had a few fighters themselves try mind games with us. But John, let's start with you. Mind games, how important are they and how important can they be in boxing? I mean, obviously, I think the key things are pre-fight press conferences and probably the weigh-ins when we have these face-to-faces or head-to-heads. Does anyone get anything out of them?
I think they do. I mean, I've always thought that. And when I've been involved with them, I've kind of come to think that that is even more the case, because very often in fights, you have two fighters, particularly if it's at championship level, who are physically very, very similar. So the mental edge is something that can propel them to a different level and can sow seeds of uncertainty in their mind of opponents. And I think actually that the mind games in boxing are absolutely vital. And it's been proved not only over recent years, it's been proved over decades.
Let me ask you this, actually, John, because you've obviously done other sports as well. Is it a sporting thing, you know, on the athletics track and all that kind of stuff? Does it transcend, or is it more so in boxing and heightened because of the type of contest it is?
I think it's more so in boxing, because you're trying to gain a physical dominance over your opponent one way or another. You know, if you're on an athletics track, okay, you've got to produce your best performance on the day. But, you know, you're talking about who's the fastest, who can throw it the furthest or whatever. And you're not actually trying to physically intimidate your opponent, which in boxing you are. I think it's probably more important in boxing than pretty much any other sport I could think of. I suppose combat sports, you know, mixed martial arts, etc., maybe, but boxing, it's certainly right up there.
Ian, John said that key word, intimidation. That's a big part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I just wonder though, you know, go back in history, were there mind games with Joe Louis and Homicide Hank Henry Armstrong and Jack Johnson, Rocky Marciano, Sugar Ray Robinson? I'm not sure there were. I don't think that was part of the culture. Wasn't it Ali that started all this? I slightly disagree with John. I'm trying to think of how many fights were actually won at the press conference. You know, all these mind games, there's a lot of talk. It's sexy talk. I get all that. But it's no good if you don't have the talent to back it up in the ring. And of course, Muhammad Ali did, didn't he? He started it all really with the poems and the predictions, and everybody loved it. And, you know, he fired off the big ugly bear thing against Sonny Liston, but he backed it up. He backed it up because he was just brilliant in the ring. They can't all back it up. And sometimes, frankly, the mind games are just pathetic. Absolutely pathetic.
They can be pathetic, but they can also certainly sow huge seeds of doubt. And Ali was a master at it. And in all the fights, all the big fights that I've been involved in since then, I think it's pretty much it's certainly in a very large proportion of them, it's played a part.
John, isn't this play acting? You know, people go to the press conferences these days and they think they have to do that as part of the culture. They have to go into the trash talk. And it just doesn't suit some fighters to do it. Others are very good at carrying it off. You know, Sugar Ray Leonard was good because he was a great talker, and Angelo Dundee, who trained him, same kind of thing as well at Ali. But it still comes down to what you've got when you get in that ring. So I don't know. Name me a fight you think was won by mind games by a guy who wouldn't have otherwise done it.
Steve Collins.
Ooh, I like that. Steve Collins over Eubank.
Well, there you are. That's, you know, that I'd accept that was a big part in that particular fight, because Collins pulled that off, that little masterstroke, claiming he'd been hypnotized and wouldn't feel the pain. And he spooked Eubank, who, of course, it was post the Michael Watson near tragedy. So, yeah, that did play a big factor in that fight. So touche, one up to you, John.
let me volunteer another one. I mean, it's interesting because you put the kicker on there, that the fight that wouldn't have been won otherwise, but I feel there was a momentum shift when Bernard Hopkins went over to Puerto Rico and threw down the Puerto Rican flag in front of Felix Trinidad.
Absolutely.
And Trinidad lost his mind and never really got back on the job at hand.
Absolutely. I mean he, Hopkins, outraged a whole country, never mind Trinidad.
Yeah, he escaped. Yeah. He escaped a near riot, didn't he? Which was great. But I love the fact that you guys are going back and forth with this. And I think, Ian, you're probably right in the sense that, you know, Ali certainly made it fashionable. I think, John, there's one that you might remember one more. It's only, you know, it's not something I've prepared here, but with Ian saying sometimes it doesn't work out. Do you remember recently, relatively recently, George Groves and his Rubik's Cube ahead of the Cole Frotch fight? And he took his Rubik's Cube to the pre-fight press conference trying to get Frotch animated or something, trying to say that he, you know, could figure him out and all the rest of it. And he was trying to complete his Rubik's Cube by the time Frotch had finished his monologue. And it just seemed very strange, and it didn't really work, did it?
No.
Do you not think that George actually got to Frotch a bit in that first fight? You know, forget the second fight, because the second fight, you know, was altogether different. I think there was a certainty in Frotch that he knew he could knock him out in that second fight. But the first fight, I thought he did get to Frotch a bit. And I think the fact that he dominated him in the early stages of the fight only kind of added to that.
Well, yes. I mean, I agree with you there. I mean, he rubbed. I was more specifically talking about the Rubik's Cube, which Frotch didn't just get or buy into. But I think, you know, in terms of getting to Frotch, yes, he wound him up the wrong way terribly, didn't he? He was, you know, Frotch was like, who are you to challenge me? I've been fighting Kessler and Abraham and all these guys, and you've had about 15 or 17 fights or whatever. And now you think you're going to knock me off my perch, and I've paid my dues and you haven't paid yours. He terribly got to Frotch, which is probably one of the reasons why Groves had such success early in. And I think it's important to mention this, because obviously Ian's talking about, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. Well, one of the things that Frotch did to rectify it was he hired Chris Marshall, the sports psychologist from Team GB, to get so that Groves's mind games didn't play such a part in the second fight, to try and keep his mind on the job at hand. So I think it's interesting that some people are trying to make themselves bulletproof to these mind games in this day and age.
I think time round with the old Rubik's Cube, he was trying to, perhaps as much as anything, say that he was not only his physical rival, he was also an intellectual rival, and that intellectually, mentally, he was superior.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't give the Rubik's Cube to the commentators, because we'd have struggled, wouldn't we?
Oh, that's great stuff. That's great stuff. But I see what you're saying. I mean, Ian, where do you think that there is the opportunity for these guys to get an edge? Is it through the media? Is it at the weigh-in? Is that the last chance? And I mean, you were there probably at that famous time where I think Ricky Hatton said he really shot himself in the foot and got too pumped up at the weigh-in for the Mayweather fight. And he sort of lost his concentration, really, in the sense that he was too caught up in the crowd and the theatrics and sort of peaked for the fight week at the weigh-in, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good call, Tris. I think he did, absolutely. He was extremely pumped, and there was that huge crowd that you got in Las Vegas, because, you know, there were thousands and thousands of British fans there. I mean, it goes up every time you hear how many fans there were there, but it was a lot. And, Ricky played to the gallery, didn't he? Grabbed the microphone and did a speech and all that, and you're thinking, while you're watching it, what's he doing here? What's he doing here? He just needs to get on those scales, weigh in, do the photograph, get back to his room and concentrate on what is a mountainous task. And I remember saying, I mean, this isn't being wise after the event, turning around to people like Bob Mee and Jim Watt and saying, I didn't like that at all. And Jim, who's very wise, at these kind of things, and he doesn't say much. He just watches on at these press conferences and weigh-ins, and he just said, nope, don't like it either. So I don't know if that was a prophecy of what was going to carry on anyway. But I mean, look, Mayweather was going to win the fight anyway, wasn't he?
Yeah, I can think of another one, talking Mayweather. We now know, with 3 or 4 years on from the fight, 3 years on from the fight, we know now that Tank, Gervonta Davis, is an outstanding fighter. But when he came over to Britain to fight Liam Walsh, he was very much more of an untested sort of talent. We didn't at that stage know just how good he was going to become. Now, at the press conference for that, you got Liam Walsh, who was, as ever, just had his brothers Ryan and Michael there, and and Frank Warren, but I don't think he anticipated what was coming, because it turned into the Floyd Mayweather show. Mayweather came across with Davis, and he turned that press conference into a show about him and about Davis as his prospect. And I don't believe that Walsh would have beaten Davis anyway, but I think actually in that press conference, in that half hour or whatever it was, Walsh was so overawed and intimidated to have been absolutely in the spotlight at the feet of a worldwide global superstar. I think he pretty much froze.
Yeah, and then Ian, you've got these things as well. Obviously, we do, there's probably another episode to do on grudges. But when you talk about mind games, if guys hate one another, they're always looking to get one over on each other. I mean, it's I think you probably did De La Hoya against Fernando Vargas, and sometimes these guys really hate each other, and they're just after an edge in any way, shape, or form, aren't they?
Well, I think the best build-ups to fights are you want a bit of edge between the fighters. It helps to sell the tickets, and the promoters love it. But the real edge is when you know it's absolutely genuine and not staged and phony ballyhoo for the press conference. And the classic example of that really is Barrera and Morales, who at the time detested another. They were both great fighters, and we got a great fight, but we also got a great build-up as well, with them both hurling the insults. But I think the guy we really need to talk about is Ricardo Mayorga, isn't it? Who had any number of big money fights, and in some of them he looked good for a time as well. I mean, but there was a wild man, a crazy man, who questioned Oscar De La Hoya's sexuality and insulted his family, among many, many things that he did in the ring. But I'd argue that he got a lot of those big fights and paydays because he was box office and because he did those things.
Yeah, 100%. And I think Mayorga rubbed people like Oscar up the wrong way because of who they were. I mean, this is a guy who was, smoking cigars on the scales and eating pizzas and weigh-ins and, just doing everything he could to try and annoy and frustrate his opponent. But obviously, when you look at mind games, you'd have to say he was an inferior boxer to Vernon Forrest, but Vernon Forrest couldn't get beyond the mind games. He couldn't, and Mayorga had him dancing to his tune. And, sometimes you've just got that number. And I think, John, you would have seen it firsthand, probably, with Tyson Fury and Vladimir Klitschko. Vladimir just didn't know what was going on, did he?
No, he couldn't cope with it. Here was a man who was just off the scale in bizarre behavior as far as he could tell. And Fury, as we know now, has become just a master at winding his opponents up. When he fought Deontay Wilder first time, it started out as a bit of a pantomime and it was fairly good humored, but it went on and it went on, and sort of endless social media tirades against him, calling him a big useless dosser, etc., etc. Eventually, that little bit of a fun exchange which we had when Wilder first came over to London to set the scene for the first fight in Los Angeles, it became more and more one of animosity. And after the second fight, when of course Fury changed his tactics and went out and beat Wilder up, pretty much. When it came to the third fight, the dislike was so palpable that Wilder virtually refused to take part in any sort of pre-match face-to-face hype. When we got over to Las Vegas, Wilder just didn't want to know. You know, he was almost at the point of looking away and just refusing to engage with Fury. Fury got to him to such an extent, and that animosity there was absolutely genuine. And, you know, I mean, Ian, I'd remember, of course, going back, what you're talking about, over 30 years, Eubank and Ben, I'm absolutely convinced that Eubank absolutely got into the head of Nigel Benn to the extent that Benn went into that ring in the first fight like a man possessed and blew himself out through his own being overcharged and overhyped for the fight as much as what he was getting back from Eubank.
Yeah, I'm not sure I totally agree with you about that, John. If I'm honest, I think Eubank might have won the fight anyway against Ben, because I think Ben was at a stage of his development there where he'd got things done mostly by being, you know, very, very aggressive and believing in his ability as a big puncher who would take opponents out. So I don't know if it was so much the mind stuff of it, about the various quality of the two fighters at that particular juncture. So, I mean, that's where I have a slight argument. I mean, I think the mind games are fun. And I love all the talk and I love all the gimmicks that go with it, unless it becomes, you know, racist, homophobic. And we've had that once or twice, and tasteless. We don't need that. Boxing doesn't need that. But generally, it's good fun. And I think that should be kind of the measure of it, that it's pretty good fun. But I don't know. I think the results of most fights would probably be the same. I think, you know, I always used to say, look, I can get wound up with what's being said in the build-up to this fight. What have they actually done in the ring? What are their qualities? That's going to probably decide it a bit more. But I take your point, John. You've listed a few fights you thought were won beforehand, and you're probably right about that. But I do think that, you know, we're there for the week of a fight, aren't we, usually? You know, around the fight for the whole week. So you've got to talk about something. And it's great copy, and it's great stuff to talk about. But I don't know. I think when it comes to it, you look at what they've done in the ring, and that's usually the decisive factor.
We had a tweet, actually, from one of our regular viewers and listeners, Mike Hills, who said that, in his opinion, if Foreman had fought Ali in the United States rather than in Africa, when Ali used everything possible to get to Foreman one way or another and make him feel as though he wasn't only fighting him, he was fighting a whole country. Mm. He said that if he had fought Ali in America, it could well have been a very different story.
Well, that's an interesting theory. There's a whole book in that, I reckon, John. You're saying the Rumble in the Jungle, if it wasn't in the jungle and had been in the MGM Grand in Las Vegas, Foreman would have won it. That's a big call.
Well, it's not my call. It's a suggestion from one of our regular listeners. Yeah. And you know, you can kind of get where he's coming from. If it had been in, well, it wouldn't have been the MGM Grand, would it? It'd have probably been in the Madison Square Garden. Had it been there, would Ali have had the same advantages that he managed to put together by playing mind games when he was over in Africa? It's an interesting, I'm not saying it's necessarily the case, but you can certainly sort of hear the arguments. And having seen the way in which Foreman had just absolutely brutalized Joe Frazier when he fought him in Jamaica, you kind of think, well, maybe there's a point in that.
You don't think Ali would have still thought of that rope-a-dope was the right way to go, faced with what he was faced with?
He may well have done. But would Foreman have been kind of had so much playing against him had he been in America over in Africa? It's an interesting one, as you say. There's certainly an article in it. There's almost a book in it.
Well, yeah. people, you know, we obviously, people can go back through our archives and listen to a Ringside Rewind with Colonel Bob Sheridan, who said that he noticed a change in everything while he was out there, and that how momentum went towards Ali quite dramatically in the build-up, and how the sort of general feeling over there switched to Ali, which, you know, if Mike Hills is right, it wouldn't have happened if the fight had been in America, which is quite interesting.
And of course, Foreman had that small injury, didn't he? Which put back the cut, which put back the fight, and yeah. He was kind of made to stay in Africa, where he clearly wasn't comfortable, where Ali was making the most of the hero worship that was coming his way. And psychologically, was he right by the time he got in the fight? I don't know. You know, I mean, it'd be interesting to get George's take on that.
Yeah, it would be very interesting.
Yeah, I think, you know what, I just wanted to go back to Fury, because obviously we touched upon him. I think the Vladimir thing was a similar dislike to a sort of Groves Froch, in the sense that he didn't know what to do with him. But one thing I can say about Fury is, in my access to him over the years, is I went out with BT Sport to, I think, to do a press conference for his second fight with Deontay Wilder. And I had to do behind-the-scenes interviews with Fury and Wilder, just grabs after their press conference. So, you know, less than 5 minutes each, but a couple of sound bites from each. So I grab Wilder, and he's typically bombastic, and I grab Fury, and he's fine. And they've been nothing but friendly with one another through the press conference. And as I walk down the corridor with Fury, and this is like a three-fight press tour where you've got, I think, New York, Vegas, and Los Angeles. We're in Los Angeles. Fury said, right, yeah, be as nice as pie with him today. We'll turn the screws in Las Vegas tomorrow, and give him something completely different, so he doesn't know what to expect, whether he's going to be pushing and shoving him one day, whether he's going to be polite and, you know, throw verbal bouquets at him the next day, whether he's going to be completely standoffish, just to keep him guessing the entire time. And I think that's a very clever thing, because, you know, if you see someone and they've got an incredible set of mood swings, you've probably got no idea what's coming.
No, I think that's certainly got to Vladimir. I mean, I remember when we had the press conference for the fight, which never happened. And I was sitting alongside Vladimir, who, as you know, Triz, is normally such a cool, articulate, educated individual. And normally, he just doesn't react, absolutely doesn't. And Fury came in and started taking his shirt off, showing him how fat he was. And he said, "You got beaten by a fat man," you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you could sense Vladimir getting more and more wound up, to the point where, with the microphone in his hand, he looked at him and he told him to F off. Now, I've never heard Klitschko swear in a public environment before. I've never seen him lose his temper before, but I was sitting right next to him, and I tell you, he was absolutely furious that day, and he certainly had lost his temper.
Hey, but he didn't like it when Hay had the headless T-shirts. Do you remember, of the decapitated brothers of Vitaly and Vladimir? That kind of blew up in David's face, didn't it?
It did. Yeah. I do remember that. And you know, I mean, another thing you've got to remember at that time, running up to that fight, which we didn't really know at the moment, but the Klitschko's dad, who was suffering from terminal cancer, having been involved in the Chernobyl incident and helping relieve the problems there. He was almost literally on his deathbed. So there was a hell of a lot going on. And Vladimir was, I think, a lot more fragile at that time than people realised.
Yeah, I mean, that was a terrible thing that David Hay did. I mean, talk about tasteless. That's pathetic, isn't it, what he did ahead of that fight? I mean, who'd think of that?
Well, while we're in the mix of this sort of generation and heavyweights, let's talk about Derek Chisora, who on that memorable weekend in Munich slapped Vitaly Klitschko a weigh-in to fight before their fight, and then spat water in Vladimir's face just before he was going to fight Vitaly. I mean, is that mind games, or is that just wild behavior?
Just wild behavior.
Yeah, it was just crazy, wasn't it?
Who won the fight? Remind me.
Vitaly, pretty handsomely. Hey. Yeah, but Chisora was actually good in that fight, you know. I wonder if maybe that was part of the thing that, you know, getting Vitaly to lose his cool and get him to engage a little bit more.
Well, you striking it, you raise an interesting point, I think, Tris. If you want to just twist this round a little bit, if you're one of those guys who thinks ahead of the press conference and ahead of the fight, I've got to try something different here. I've got to come up with a mind game. Aren't you kind of saying to the other guy, yeah, I'm not going to be able to do this by normal means in the ring. I'm going to have to come up with something a little bit different ahead of time. Of course, you know, we go back to Steve Collins and Chris Eubank, and, you know, he did everything possible to put Eubank off, you know, in talking Gaelic at the first press conference, all that kind of stuff, and dressing up as an Irish country gentleman. But I wonder, sometimes you go to a press conference, you think, I've got to do this, I've got to spit water at somebody or try to attack them to cause an incident. Okay, it's good ticket selling stuff, a lot of it, but maybe if you're the guy who's the champion and has been the champion for a long time and you're the favorite for the fight, I wonder what you're actually thinking. I wonder what Mike Tyson thought when he sat there at press conferences and people came up with all this stuff about how they had kryptonite to beat him and how they were going to shock the world. He just sat there stony-faced, didn't he? He'd done it all in the ring and just said, we'll see Saturday.
And of course, we know that he was possibly, in his prime, the most intimidating fighter that you and I ever saw, Ian.
Yeah, and he didn't need it, did he? I mean, he didn't need the mind games. Hagler didn't need mind games. You know, Azuma Nelson, Joe Calzaghe even, Oscar De La Hoya. I didn't hear him trash-talking that much. Had a fight. He said Lloyd Hannigan, one of our great fighters, probably one of the most underrated British fighters ever. I don't think I ever heard Lloyd do too much other than call himself the ragamuffin man in interviews beforehand. He went in there and performed. I mean, the guy who he had that horrible grudge with was Marlon Starling, wasn't it? You know, I mean, those two disliked each other. So there might've been a bit of verbal crossfire ahead of that one. But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of the really best fighters, I think. You know, Lennox, in many ways, okay, he had that bust up with Tyson, but he didn't really go in for insulting the opponents because I don't think he felt he needed that.
I actually bought into the entire Steve Collins shtick and I thought it was very impressive. And you guys will remember this because, you know, this is partly mind games and partly keeping his mind on the job. You'll remember as Eubank made this, you know, long and drawn out entrance to Simply the Best. Collins had his robe on, his the hood pulled over him, and he had headphones in. And he was listening to what I guess was a Walkman at the time.
Yeah.
And just completely in his own space, wasn't he? And, you know, Eubank had to look over and think, you know, I'm not getting through the shield. You know, I'm not breaking through like I would normally do so, right?
Yeah, maybe he was listening to that hypnotism tape again that didn't actually ever exist.
Yeah, maybe he didn't have a cassette in there either. Yeah, it's
amazing. Maybe there was nothing going on. I suspect there was, I mean, he was on the Harley Davidson, wasn't he, doing the ring entrance? Collins knew what was going to happen, and he'd obviously made his plan about how he would totally ignore it.
Yeah. Chris completely spooked him, though, didn't he, the day before? When, or rather, Chris was completely spooked the day before by what Collins said. You know, it was that interview which I'd done for BBC Radio on my old reel-to-reel tape recorder, and I played it back to Chris, and it's Collins talking about how the fact he'd be hypnotized, he'd feel no pain, he wouldn't bleed, you know, and Chris was just appalled by this. He thought, you know, if I hit him and I hurt him, then how's he going to know that he's been hit and been hurt? And therefore, it's dangerous again. And I think he really did see the whole Watson scenario, Michael Watson scenario, possibly unfolding once again. And he literally said, I'm not going to go through with this fight. He told Barry Hearn, this fight is off. And for a few hours, it was.
Yeah, and Barry, I mean, basically told him, I think, well, people will say you're running scared and, you know, you'll do untold damage to your reputation. That was the only way, I think, that the fight was on. So, yeah, you playing that tape to Chris Eubank, you nearly caused a big bit of boxing history there, John, I think, because we'd gone a long way out to Mill Street. We could hardly find the place in the countryside near Cork. But what a night that all was. What an incredible thing it was. I mean, yeah, that was a bit of a masterstroke. It was almost the ultimate masterstroke, wasn't it, by Collins? But I don't know. I was talking about that fight again this week. And, you know, I think there are times in a fighter's life where they're just not going to be beaten that night. I think it happened with Ricky Hatton against Costas Yu. It was their night. And I think Collins was just going to walk through walls that night to prevail.
So I remember seeing Freddie Roach before the fight, Ian. And he kind of explained to me how they were going to beat him. He said, we will make him fight for 3 minutes of every round. And he can't do that. He said, all the posing, the posturing, the banging of gloves, the walking around the ring, he said, that's all about the fact that he doesn't want to fight for 3 minutes. And he said, Steve will make him fight for 3 minutes.
He did that, and he stayed in punching range the whole time, just wouldn't let him go, wouldn't let him away.
Yeah. So, Ian, let me ask you this, because we did touch upon it for Mike Tyson. And we've got a question here from Tony Farmer. He says, has there been a more intimidating fighter than a young Tyson? The fight was over before it started. And didn't Bruno cross himself something like 50 times before the bell sounded? So you guys are both saying in unison that it wasn't really a Tyson shtick. It was just everyone was afraid of the violence that was associated with him. He didn't go out of his way to inflict mind games upon people. It was just the way he was. He was just being Tyson.
Where later on in his career, I think he became aware that he had that effect, that reputation, and he used it and almost played up and became a slightly a parody of himself. I think that line about, you know, eating Lennox Lewis's children that he came out with about after beating Lou Savarese in Glasgow, that was him, I think, playing to the cameras. And, you know, maybe too, you know, when he came out with that horrible quote about driving somebody's nose bone up into their brain. Remember that horrible stuff that he came out? I think he kind of knew what his reputation was and that he was frightening and could beat most opponents before the bell. And we go back to what we talked about in the, you know, our Evander Holyfield episode. When he came to Evander Holyfield, he came up against a fighter who just didn't care two hoots, really, and wasn't frightened of him at all. In fact, actually relished getting in the ring with him to the extent that he was singing songs to himself as he climbed between the ropes.
Yeah, November 9th was 26 years ago, you know, since that fight happened. And I was re-watching it, and you forget how Holyfield ultimately didn't just beat him, he absolutely beat him up, you know, having refused to be intimidated, as perhaps Michael Spinks had been back in 1988 or whenever it was. You know, he refused to be intimidated in that manner. And he was not... He was mentally stronger, and therefore he produced the performance he did, which was Holyfield's finest hour.
Ian, you alluded to it earlier. You said about the darker side of mind games, and it would be remiss not to mention it, but you probably won't thank me for it. But obviously Alan Minter with his I'm not going to lose to a black man, and Bernard Hopkins with I'm not going to lose to a white boy. Neither did themselves any favours in any way, shape or form, be it in the ring or out of the ring, with those claims.
Yeah, that was most unfortunate ahead of the Hagler fight. But I tell you what, Marvin Hagler was class itself, because he came straight from the airport to a press conference in the West End of London when he arrived in England. And without being asked any questions, he stood up in the smartest of pinstripe suits and with a very sharp shirt and tie on, and said, gentlemen, I have something to say to you. I've read what my opponent has said about not wanting to lose his title to a black man. I absolutely abhor that remark, and I seriously resent any suggestion that there's any racist element at all to this fight. It's not about the colors of our skin. This title will be decided on Saturday night by which man is the better man, and you'll find out that the better man will be me. You know, he was class itself the way he dealt with that and tried to defuse it. But of course, you know, it was a horrible, ugly night with bottles, and they weren't plastic bottles, being thrown down. We had to sort of hide behind underneath the ring apron, me and Desmond Lynham. Des was doing the commentary. I was doing like some of the reports there that night. And it was frightening. And of course, all Hagler's corner men had to cover him up and put him more or less inside a shell in the ring so that he didn't get hit as well. And, you know, it's well documented now that he always resented Great Britain for that he wasn't able to celebrate his great night when he became the world middleweight champion. Though later on, I have to tell you, I did an interview with him where he said he'd had loads of letters from proper boxing fans in England that he would now be very happy to come back.
John, let me ask you about Hopkins and Calzaghe. What do you think Hopkins was trying to get out of it? Because Calzaghe wouldn't have given given, I'm trying to think of a polite word, but you know what I mean? McCansey wouldn't have cared less about what Hopkins said. It wasn't, you know, it's a different time, wasn't it? I mean, it's race not really relevant in an insult like that, right?
Yeah, I remember. So I was over there, and it was all fairly unpleasant, and it was kind of unexpected. But there has been on occasion a side to Bernard Hopkins, which is not quite as charming as you would be led to believe from some of his interviews. And it's unacceptable, isn't it? And I think he let himself down massively by saying that. Whether he was trying to get Joe angry, possibly so. But Joe was on the. It was actually a fairly competitive fight, but Joe was just a bit too much for him, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think you're right. But, you know, how about this? So Andrew Harrison said Hopkins was good, but took a massive L trying to wind up Calzaghe. It's the fathers who seem to be at it more these days. So Guerrero, Garcia, Lopez, Teofimo Lopez, Danny Garcia and Garcia Sr. And you get that. But like you guys, obviously, John, you mentioned Freddie there, but sometimes the trainers and the dads, or the trainers, or the dads, they also get involved in it to an extent, don't they? I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, trainers that really buy into it. You must have seen it between you in one way, shape, or form. I'm just trying to think. But trainers getting involved and trying to stir the pot, shall we say.
Well, we had some interesting stories back in the 90s and some interesting people. I mean, most of the real top guys, people like Eddie Futch and like Angelo Dundee were class acts, weren't they? And they wouldn't sully their hands with saying stupid things. But you got others, you know. I mean, when Panama Lewis was sort of drifting around the periphery, he was a fairly loathsome figure. And some of the people who Tyson had around him in his latter stages as trainers were not what you would describe as the classiest people in the game. And sometimes trainers want to get involved, don't they, in the hype to make themselves maybe feel a little bit more important than they actually are.
Yeah, who was Jerry Cooney's trainer? I'm trying to think. Didn't he come out with that line to Larry Holmes at the press conference saying, like, we kind of figured that Larry was going to never make it as a brain surgeon. And we got a message for you, Larry, like, tick, 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 tick. Your time is up. Your time is up. He was going all through this kind of stuff. I'm trying to think who that was now. But, Rappaport, was it?
Dennis Rappaport, yeah.
Yeah. So, the trainers do get involved, don't they? Some, like John said, some more than others. I remember Angelo Angelo didn't get involved. Of course, he had Muhammad Ali and Sugar Ray Leonard, who he didn't really much need to get involved with. They were well able to speak for themselves. But I remember him saying something that proved significant at a press conference ahead of the fight with Thomas Hearns. And he said to the journalists, "One thing you've all failed to grasp, and I've read all your previews of the fight, and I've enjoyed your previews of the fight, but you're not grasping one thing here. My guy's the puncher in this fight. Believe me, my guy's the puncher, not Hearns." Well, you know, look what happened in the fight, how he turned it around, didn't he? Throwing those big power shots to turn the fight around and win Sugar Ray Leonard. You know, that's for me, that's one of the great fights in history.
And I suppose the thing is as well, you've got to, Ian, I'll stick with you on this. Leonard is one of the great gamesmen, isn't he? I mean, when you think about how he lured Duran into their rematch, and in fact, King Kev 15 said about this, how about Leonard Duran, Leonard being sucked into Duran's fight? So I suppose it's 50-50 in that respect, because in the first fight, obviously, Duran was taunting Leonard's wife and making it very personal, wasn't he? But then there was the complete switch around in the rematch when, you know, on Leonard's calling, basically Leonard went straight back into training camp. Duran went and got bloated and put on weight and enjoyed the victory. And Leonard basically summoned him to this immediate rematch. And it was a full about turn, wasn't it? Incredible. And then obviously with Leonard, while we're on it, I mean, no one did this, but he toyed with Marvin Hagler psychologically, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He did. But going back to the Duran fight, I mean, that is interesting because I do think there was a mental element to that. I mean, I think Leonard's ego beat him in that first fight in Montreal because he was trying to say to Roberto Duran, you're right, Tris. He taunted his wife, Juanita, I think her name was, at the time, and brought her into the argument. But what Leonard was trying to say, I think, to Duran was, you're the big macho man. I tell you what, I won't beat you the way, you know, that most people think, like just outbox you and just be too slick and fast for you. No, I'll fight you in your own fight as well. I'll be a macho man. Let's see who's toughest. He actually thought he could do it that way and paid the price. But of course, in that second fight, you're right, Duran probably wasn't in the same kind of shape and didn't have the same edge and, you know, ended up turning his back, famously, the no mass fight. You know, Leonard did what he should have done in the first fight. He had the tools, didn't he, to have won both of them, I think. But he made the big tactical error, and maybe he was lured into the tactical error by Duran's pre-fight taunts.
And how about the Hagler fight, Ian, with Leonard? Because obviously he invited Hagler to his retirement speech and retired in front of him, and then came out of retirement, you know, and fought him down the line. He had Hagler like a puppet on a string, really, didn't he?
Well, I've never known in the entire time I covered boxing a fight Hagler Leonard, which divided the opinion of so many people I regarded as very good judges of a fight. Some thought Hagler had done enough. Some felt Leonard had done enough. I might have told the story before. Apologies if you'd heard it before, about several years later. It bugged Leonard that people questioned it. So I rang him when he was with HBO in Atlantic City for a fight, and I was working for BBC Radio before John came on the scene, and rang him and said, would you do an interview with us for BBC Radio? I rang his hotel room and he said, the Hagler, he goes, my fight with Hagler, how did you score it? I said, well, I said, as a matter of fact, I said, I had you winning it by you know, just about a round. He goes, be here at 4:30, room 418. And I had the impression that had I said, you know, I thought Hagler probably won, I wouldn't have got the interview. So,
well, I know from the other side, Ian, talking to Marvin before he died, it really did rankle with him,
yeah,
right the way through that verdict went against him. I suspect right to his dying day, he believed in his heart of hearts that he won that fight and that Leonard conned the judges out of it. I actually go with you. I think Leonard did enough. I thought Marvin did precious little in the first half of the fight, came on strong a little bit later on, but by then the fight had been lost.
Yeah, I think he first four rounds, John, that night.
Yeah.
Hagler.
Yeah.
And of course, he didn't turn up early on. I suppose Hagler did the only, you know, Hagler, who didn't have any control apart from obviously over the amount that he made, which I think in terms of he made more than Leonard for that fight because of the negotiations and the deal he eventually struck. But the only way that he would ever get one over on Leonard is retiring and taking the ball out of Leonard's court and saying, there's not going to be a rematch. It's the only controllable that Hagler had, was to walk away and never come back. It's the only thing he could control, because he couldn't control any other part of negotiations or any contractual part of a rematch. The only thing he could control was walking away and not coming back. And he was that stubborn a man that's probably what happened.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it would have pleased him that, you know, there's a lot about perception, isn't there, in boxing, what was perceived to have happened, that a lot of people did feel he was robbed. Because Hagler always had a thing, didn't he, about Vegas judges. He hated the place and didn't trust anybody in Las Vegas, all going back to the, you know, that draw that was declared the first time he challenged for the title against Vito Antuofermo. That never left his mind. It's interesting, we talk about mind games. I think with Hagler, it was in his own mind. He fought with that huge chip on his shoulder the whole way through his career. And that's how he carried on fighting like a challenger, even when he was champion and reigned as long as he did.
He was the archetypal blue-collar champion, wasn't he? Believed nobody ever at any stage did him any favours whatsoever. He kind of won and became a great despite the system rather than because of it.
would never talk to anybody in the week of the fight, Hagler. You know, you try and get an interview with him. I remember going up to him once and saying, hello, Ian Dark from the BBC. He said, congratulations, what do you want? I said, well, minutes of your time. I'm not giving any of my time to anybody. I'm preparing for a championship fight. Goodbye. That was as far as any of us ever got. and then they linked him up to so all the American writers complained about it and said to, you know, they said to Bob Arum, look, this is completely unworkable. We can't work this fight and preview your fight and sell your fight if we don't ever get to talk to Hagler. So they linked him up. They linked him up ahead of, I think it was the Simpson fight, to Cape Cod, where he was training. So all the journalists are in this hotel in Worcester, Massachusetts, and Hagler's in Cape Cod. He won't have the journalists go to the camp. So they're on this line, and it starts off, hi, Eddie Schuyler here from Associated Press. Yep. That's Hagler. And he goes, Do we speak to you at all about why you won't talk to us in the week of a fight? And Hagler goes, did you talk to my trainer about this? And then Discalis said, we sure did. He goes, you don't need to talk to me then. This is over. Bye. that was as long as the press conference lasted.
Oh, that's great stuff. Great stuff. Hey, we've got some questions in via Twitter, so let's get to some of these. We've touched upon different parts of them, some of them already, but let's look at. So Bernard O'Shea actually says, we'd be remiss not to talk about Richard Dunne being hypnotized by Romark the Magician. That was an epic fail if ever there was one. But Bernard also goes on to say, and this is pre Las Vegas weigh-in, Ian, so you can have a shot at this, but what about Mayweather Jr.'s Man United shirt sombrero against Hatton and Canelo? So obviously trying to rile him up. And obviously, you know, you were there, I think, with Ricky's expletive press conference in the rain with Mayweather trying to galvanize the red side of Manchester. And then obviously trying to galvanize the Hispanic crowd ahead of Canelo. Any mileage in that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, that was a bit of a classic ploy, wasn't it, by Mayweather to put a Manchester United shirt on. He'd obviously been well advised, hadn't he, about Hatton. I mean, one thing I remember about Mayweather once was he was walking behind me into a press conference, you know, down some corridor, and he was singing that song that the fans sing to himself, walking along, singing a song, walking in a Hatton Wonderland. What's going on here? But yeah, I mean, you'll try anything, won't you? Really, ahead of those fights. So, yeah, that was probably a smart move. But again, I'll go back to our original point. I don't think it affected the result.
Sure. And John, so this is kind of a reiteration, but from Dan Harris, he says, I think also Eubank got to Ben in their first fight. I remember Eubank saying he would beat him in every facet of boxing. You just sensed that Ben wanted the KO too much, and Eubank exploited that in the build-up. So kind of making someone too mad and too desperate that they basically lose their head and the red mist descends.
Well, there was certainly a very palpable dislike from the Ben side of Chris Eubank. Whether or not Chris Eubank was kind of more measured and was just playing the game and deliberately trying to rile Ben, I'm not too sure. But certainly I do remember at the time from, what are we talking, over 30 years ago, the sheer dislike in Nigel Benn of Chris Eubank. And I do think that when it came to the fight, maybe he wouldn't have won it anyway, as Ian says, but I do think he was overhyped and he went in there, you know, just wanting to annihilate Chris Eubank if he possibly could. And I think any boxer would agree that that's not the way to do it. You know, you have to work your way to the opportunity to actually do that. And I don't think that Nigel really did.
Yeah. Oh, you mentioned Richard Dunne back there, Tris, from one of our correspondents, and that fight with Muhammad Ali. There is a funny story about that, where Mickey Duff had asked Muhammad Ali before the fight and said to him, can I have your gloves to auction for charity afterwards? And Ali said to him, yeah, sure. So he's won in five rounds. And Mickey Duff gets in the ring and says to Ali, you haven't forgotten the gloves, Muhammad. He goes, I ain't forgotten. And they rip the gloves off and he gives them to Mickey Duff, who goes, "Thanks, Muhammad." And as he's walking away, Ali says to him, "Have a look inside the linings." And in one of them, it says, "Ali KO done." And in the other lining, it said, "Round five."
Wow. Great stuff.
That's a great story. That just brings to mind the story when he fought, was it the Belgian, Koopman, who was totally, totally outclassed. And Ali supposedly leaned over the ropes and talked to the television directors at ringside. And he said, "Have you got all your advert breaks in yet? I can't keep this sucker up much longer."
I think that was the fight where Koopmans had been told on his way from the airport, "Look, when you get in the press conference, you know, you've got to kind of play a bit of a role here and say you're going to shock the world and you know all about, you know, what Ali can do and everything, but you know, you've got the tools to beat him. That's what we need you to say." So he walks into the press conference and the first he sees Ali and rushes over to him and asks for his autograph.
Oh my god, play it cool, Rodney, play it cool. Okay so Ian, there's clearly a thirst for more knowledge on the Hatton Mayweather thing. So Mike Hill says this: Floyd played with Hatton in the lead up to their fight and Hatton was dragged along like a lost child. By fight night, Hatton had lost control of his rational mind. So too Joe Cortez. Ali and Floyd kind of refereed their own fights. The thing about Joe Cortez is interesting, isn't it? Because obviously when you talk about mind games, you know, Ricky was on a, must have felt like he was on a hide into nothing. And we talked about this, I think, before in the Hatton episode, but Ricky had a lot going on in his mind, not least America turning against him once the national anthem started to be booed outrageously on that night.
Yeah, John was there as well. And it was ridiculous, really. I mean, talk about misreading the room by the British fans. And there were a lot of them, as we've discussed, and them all booing, well, not all of them, obviously. Some people showed plenty of respect, but the Americans take their flag and their anthem very, very seriously. So there was a cacophony of boos to the American anthem. I think it made up the minds of a lot of people. I was getting glances because I was British from the American commentators along the road from me, from HBO, like, you know, what are your countrymen doing here? And I think, Cortez, I think he got into his mind as well because, you know, he didn't give Ricky a thing in that fight, did he? So, again, it didn't affect the result. But,
when you talk about American partisan crowds, I mean, obviously I was there at the back end of Hopkins Trinidad, so I was there when they actually got into the ring and fought in Madison Square Garden, and it was in the aftermath of 9/11. It was the first big sporting contest in New York afterwards, and you could feel the sense that it added to Hopkins's story, the fact that now not only had he hacked off the Puerto Ricans, but he was now doing it for the Americans as well. And there was a really, really nationalistic, fevered, you know, real fever pitch. And it, you know, even though I was a neutral and I was there as a fan, I couldn't help but feel swept up in the patriotism of the whole place at the time with the national anthem. And Don King had given emergency services hundreds of tickets to be ringside and all the rest of it. It was a really strong movement in the opposite way of what happened in Las Vegas a few years later. John, let's just finish with you. Tell me about some of the most impressive mind games you've seen, and whether it's from Fury. I think quite a few people there are asking you directly on our conversation about, you know, is Fury the best one ever? I mean, he's got a lot of facets to his game in the ring, but probably just as many outside, right?
I think he's very, very good at it. I don't think he's the best ever. I think that was clearly Muhammad Ali. And if you go back in time and listen to the interviews, you know, he was a genius. But I do think Tyson is very, very good at playing the press, the media, the new social media as well. You know, I mean, think he's the first superstar who's really got hold of Twitter, Instagram, etc., and sold himself through that and developed and brought about a massive following as a result of of working on that. But I think that's also his honesty about his own problems away from boxing and the way in which he has overcome those and has made himself into the fighter that we've all seen over the last few years. I think that has bowled over a lot of people and given him a popularity which sort of is a crossover appeal. And yes, he's very, very good at playing games with his opponents, but he's also very good at projecting himself.
Yeah, I think you come back to where we came in. You know, you've got to be good in the ring, good enough in the ring to back up all that, haven't you? And he is.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you're right. I think, you know, that's a good place to end it there, Ian, in the sense that, you know, ultimately trash talk, mind games, whatever you want to call it, accounts for nothing if you can't deliver when the bell goes. Gents, this has been a lot of fun. I didn't know it would go quite so quickly.
And we've all got through it without threatening to knock each other out at this press conference.
Well, you haven't seen what John's been messaging me since we've been... So, no, it's been great stuff, gents. I really enjoyed it. And, guys, thank you very much for tuning in to another episode of Ringside Rewind. We really appreciate your choice to listen to us. We know that it's a busy marketplace out there. So thanks for giving us your time and giving us the opportunity. If you are enjoying it, please leave a 5-star review for us on iTunes or where you choose to listen. And please spread the word about our wonderful podcast, Ringside Rewind, with me, Tris Dixon, Ian Dark and John Rawling.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.